Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Later this hour, we'll take a look at new scams in the age of AI. We'll hear from fraud experts Amy Nofziger and Aaron West about how you can spot the bot and stop the scam. Then, if you're a fan of film, you want to hear our interview with Zoe Elton, director of programming for the Mill Valley Film Festival. But first, Tylenol has long been considered the safest option for pain relief during pregnancy. But recently, headlines and the Trump administration have raised questions about whether its use could be linked to autism or ADHD in children. To help us sort through the science and what pregnant women really need to know, I'm happy to be joined by Dr. Roxana Irani. She's the Ambulatory Executive Medical Director for Women's Health at UCSF. She's also a UCSF Assistant Professor, High-Risk Board Certified Obstetrician, and she holds an MD and PhD, and she's also published research on preeclampsia, cardiovascular disease in pregnancy, fetal intervention options, and Zika what happens with Zika virus in pregnancy. In other words, Dr. Irani is an expert, and we're very happy to welcome her to State of the Bay. Welcome, Dr. Irani.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Grace, for having me.
Yeah. So as we all know, there's been a lot of recent media attention about the supposed link between Tylenol's use during a pregnancy and neurodevelopmental disorders like autism and attention deficit disorders like ADHD. What do you make of the pronouncement by the Trump administration about the science behind this alleged causation?
You know, there has been more than two decades of research about acetaminophen use in pregnancy, and there really has not been a single high-quality, highly reputable study which has successfully shown or even concluded that the use of Tylenol or acetaminophen in any trimester of pregnancy causes neurodevelopmental disorders in children. And, you know, there's a lot of high quality studies out there. And, you know, there's ones from decades ago, there's recent ones. You know, there was a recent one in April of 2024 published in JAMA, which is a highly reputable journal that clearly stated that there was no significant association between the use of Tylenol during pregnancy and the risks specifically to autism, ADHD, or other intellectual disabilities.
Well, given where the science is at, what sparked all this controversy? What is the Department of Health and Human Services relying upon when they point the finger at Tylenol?
Yeah, there was a recent study that's kind of floating around right now. There was a study recently out of Harvard that, you know, that has kind of gotten a lot of press recently because it has a pretty salacious you know, tagline suggesting an association. So if you read the abstract as, you know, a layperson without a lot of scientific background, it would sound like absolutely that there's an association between Tylenol use and pregnancy. And that's kind of what this administration is hinging on, is this study. But then when you actually like get past the soundbite, like the authors actually in the meat of the article, like clearly say, and I'm going to quote them here because I don't want to misrepresent, it's that they say our analysis demonstrated evidence consistent with an association between exposure and acetaminophen during pregnancy and offspring with NDD, so neurodevelopmental disorders, including ASD, which is the autistic spectrum disorder, and ADHD, though observational limitations preclude definitive causation. So even the authors say that there's no definitive cause in that study that this administration is citing. And so again, if you read this, the tagline, absolutely it would sound like that. But if you look at the meat of it, not true. And they actually go on to say that we recommend judicious acetaminophen use, the lowest effective dose for the shortest duration under medical guidance, tailored to individual risk benefit assessment rather than a broad limitation. Those are the author's words. And so that study that they're quoting actually affirms the current standard of care. It's what we do right now is say, yes, use it in limited ways if it's the benefits outweigh the risks.
And just to clarify, I mean, the administration has said Tylenol repeatedly, but Tylenol is a form of acetaminophen. And so it's really about acetaminophen, that particular drug, not Tylenol alone. Is that right?
Well, acetaminophen is the generic name.
Yes.
Tylenol is the brand name.
Mm-hmm. And it's one and the same, though, that
these
authors are talking
about. Yeah, they are used synonymously.
Yes.
And we have very limited pain relief options for patients, but more so it's really about fever relief. We know, especially in early pregnancy, when pregnant patients have fevers, we know that fevers can cause neurodevelopmental issues. We know that they can cause birth defects. It is so important to treat fever early in pregnancy, especially. So it's actually imperative that we still have this in our already limited toolbox for our pregnant patients.
I mean, it's such a scary piece of information for pregnant people. You want to do your best. You know, I've had children myself, and you don't want to do anything that would harm, you know, a child. So has any major medical organization changed its advice with regards to the use of acetaminophen or/slash Tylenol in pregnancy?
No, we've always said to use it for the lowest possible dose for the shortest amount of time. So the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, ACOG, which is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, have both recently put out statements to affirm the safety of limited acetaminophen use in pregnancy. And even the American Academy of Pediatrics has also approved of those endorsements. So all of the governing bodies across OBGYN and in pediatrics in the United States have affirmed that, and several others in Canada, in the UK, across Europe, have all come out with statements affirming the same.
Mm. I mean, as a scientist, as a doctor, as somebody who has treated today high risk pregnancies, how do you feel when the administration comes out with information like this, which is not supported by major medical organizations? How does it feel to be a doctor at this moment?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, I gotta say, Grace. You know, we do our best. Nobody's claiming. No, I don't claim to know everything. I don't claim that I only know what we know right now. And mm-hmm. So it's so hard to interpret data. It's so hard to interpret science. We do our best. And I can only share what we know and how we interpret it as through our governing bodies, through our own eyes. And we undergo years and years of training to be able to read these documents and to read this research. So it's really disheartening. And frankly, it's damaging. It makes our jobs a lot harder. And it's going to make our jobs a lot harder. It already has. And so we plan to share new results of new research as we learn it. And if that new research tells us something we don't know, then we should be able to, as a medical community, change those medical recommendations if it's based on high quality, peer-reviewed research. So if that happens in the future, then we will. But in this moment, we feel that it is safe to have limited Tylenol use in pregnancy. Mm.
For people who have more questions, I mean, so this is a Harvard study. And I mean, I'm sure that there are people out there saying, well, why would this study be published if it didn't say what it said or didn't say what the administration said? Is there anything about or some risk or significant or insignificant or otherwise with using acetaminophen during pregnancy?
Well, I mean, there's so many what we call confounding factors, right? So there's what they said in that study was talking about an association, which many studies have talked about in the past, but it's so hard to pick out like one pinpoint thing. And that's, I think, a part of the reason that this administration can kind of pick on autism in that way, because it's a spectrum, because there is no one gene. Mm. There is no one environmental insult that causes this disorder, this spectrum of disorders. And I just would hate for any parent or mom who took Tylenol in pregnancy to feel guilty that that was the reason, because we simply just do not know.
Yeah. And, you know, in the normal course of things, a study like this comes out, would you expect that this study would be subjected to more peer review and people would try to replicate it or kind of work off of its research to do further studies?
Absolutely. I think there's going to be a whole slew of variable quality of research that comes from this. And that's why it's going to be so eat. But I got to say, even that study doesn't say what people are interpreting of
right.
it. And so that's actually the key here. And so the authors don't claim, and they say very clearly, it precludes definitive causation. And so it's how the media and this administration is interpreting those statements. And so that's really the crux here, is that even this research doesn't point to that. But absolutely, Grace, there's going to be a lot more research done on this because of these recent proclamations that are just frankly not based in strong science.
And for, I mean, the president has said that pregnant people should just tough it out. But there must be, and as you said, acetaminophen is perfectly safe to use for the shortest amount of time, smallest amount of dose in pregnancy. But are there other alternatives that a pregnant person might be able to utilize if they are trying to control for pain or fever?
Yeah, you know, we are limited in our pain options. There's another class of medications called NSAIDs, so things like Advil, ibuprofen, naproxen. We can only use those for a pretty short course, usually 48 hours or less, and we don't offer that class of medication in the third trimester because we do have a lot of evidence that that can actually affect the baby's heart, and so we don't use that later on in the pregnancy. We certainly use gabapentin, tramadol, some other strong opioids in pregnancy, but again, we try and limit use. And so chronic pain, and I'll say too, like I take care of a lot of patients with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, and you know, they have chronic pain and it's really hard to treat in pregnancy. So a lot of the times we use things like other biologics and steroids and other modalities to help get to the root cause of the problem. So we often, you know, like that's really the important thing, to get to the root cause. So some patients in pregnancy will quote unquote tough it out, but you can't tough out a fever. You either have a fever or you don't, and it's dangerous to have a sustained fever in pregnancy. And that's really the difference here. So yes, there's the chronic pain piece, or the, you know, a short-term pain piece. You know, maybe physical therapy might be a great option. There's lots of options for that. In pain compared to fever. Fever is much harder to treat in pregnancy. And so Tylenol remains, you know, our go-to that we know is safe and is incredibly effective, especially in that first trimester where the baby's, you know, parts are developing and a fever can cause birth defects. And that is something we know and have a lot of research about.
So as we end this segment, I just want to be clear for our listeners out there. Dr. Irani, what is your best advice to pregnant patients who feel anxious after hearing headlines like this one, linking acetaminophen or Tylenol to autism?
Please talk to your obstetrician. And if you, you know, want more information, please talk to a high-risk doctor like myself. You know, there's, you know, in the Bay Area, we're very lucky to have a great infrastructure of high-risk obstetrics. We are always happy to have conversations with patients and go through the data, just like we've done today, Grace. And we understand how nerve-wracking it is. And so we want patients to feel comfortable with the recommendations that we make. And we of course, have their best interests in our minds and our hearts. And we have the interests of their fetus and newborn in our hearts as well. And we want to do the best thing for both moms and kiddos.
Hopefully one good thing that will come out of this is that there'll be a lot more money devoted to women's health.
I sure hope so.
Well, we've been speaking to Dr. Roxana Irani. She's a high-risk OBGYN at UCSF, helping us separate fact from fear when it comes to Tylenol pregnancy. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Irani.
Thanks, Grace.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, AI is helping scammers to be more convincing. We'll show you how not to be fooled. Stay with us.
I'm Lynn Winter Gross.
And I'm Miriam Goodman. We are the hosts of Not Born Yesterday. Our show explores the joys and challenges of aging with advice from experts in the field.
As the baby boomer generation ages, understanding the experiences of family caregiving and the challenges it presents is a worldwide issue. We're going to be talking all about it. Join us Monday at 7 p.m. for Not Born Yesterday.
Right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your sonic scavenger. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Artificial intelligence is transforming our lives in many positive ways, but it's also giving scammers powerful new tools to commit fraud. From cloned voices to convincing fake emails, these scams are getting harder to spot and leaving more people vulnerable. Tonight on State of the Bay, we'll explore how AI is changing the landscape of fraud and what you can do to protect yourself. Joining us is Amy Nofziger, Director of Victim Support at AARP's Fraud Watch Network. She's been tracking how scammers target communities across the country. Welcome to State of the Bay, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're also joined by Erin West. She's a former prosecutor who now leads efforts to educate the public about scams through her organization called Operation Shamrock. Thank you for joining us, Erin.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, together, this dynamic duo are going to help us understand the latest tricks and how to fight back. But before we begin, we'd love to hear from you. AI scams aren't just about phishing emails anymore. They can fake caller IDs, copy voices, and spin up realistic texts. Have you fallen or nearly fallen for such a scam, or do you know someone who has? Tell us about it. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. I'm going to give you that number. Again, it's 866-798-8255. We have a live person, not a bot, waiting to take your call. So, Erin, I wanted to start with you because, you know, your work is to try to combat these types of scams. And from your perspective as a former prosecutor, how has AI changed the kinds of scams that you're seeing?
Well, what I will say is that we are being hit by scams on an industrialized nature right now, that the scams that we are seeing are coming at us fast and furious from scam compounds that are built with the express purpose of doing this work. And right now, they are staffed with human trafficked victims. Now, what happens is when you put AI into that mix, you need fewer human trafficked workers, and you can do this scamming faster, cleaner, easier, and with less expense. And so what that means already, and what will continue to mean, is that it's easier to do more scamming at scale.
Yipes. Well, can you share an example of a case where AI, maybe voice cloning or deepfakes, played a key role in defrauding someone, Erin?
Sure. I think the problem that we have is that we are a nation of trusting people. And so when we meet someone online and they tell us who they are, we want to believe them. And we fall in love with the idea of the person that we are hearing from. And one of the victims I had this year was, he called me and he said, well, I know who my scammer is. And I said, oh, fantastic. Tell me who your scammer is. And he said, well, it's Miss Malaysia 2016. And I said, oh, wow, tell me why you think that. And he said, well, I did a reverse image search and that's who she is. And I said, oh, goodness, I'm so sorry to tell you that I think that someone was using her image and that wasn't her. But he was really convinced. And he said, no, I know it's her because I've talked to her. And Miss Malaysia has a mole and this woman has a mole. And then I explained to him what deepfakes were. And so I think that is a major concern for all of us, that the scammers are so good and their grooming techniques are so strong that when they tell you they're Miss Malaysia and they can produce an image that looks like Miss Malaysia and talk to you like Miss Malaysia, we have little choice but to believe it.
I mean, it makes me feel like it's a little bit like, oh, why did you think that Miss Malaysia would want to be talking to you about something like that? Ugh. Amy, from your work at AARP, what are some common scams that you're seeing that now involve AI?
So we're certainly seeing a lot of scams, and sometimes it's hard to pinpoint if AI is actually being used in them, because I've been doing this work for 23 years and they were pretty successful 15 years ago without the technology we have today, right? So AI is just a tool that is in their toolbox. You know, so there's no such thing as an AI scam. It's a scam that's been being used, AI is being used for the scam to perpetuate it, right? But I will agree with Aaron that the one change we have seen, and celebrity imposter scams have been popular for a really long time, but with the onset of the technology and the graphics and the deep fakes that these criminals can use to make it appear that your favorite celebrity is sending you videos, text messages to steal money from you, I mean, it's pretty intense and it's pretty real. But what I like to talk about is it's not so much what the tool or the strategy they're using, is listen for the ask, because every single scam has the same DNA. Comes out of the blue with urgency. They try to get you in a heightened emotional state. They want you to lie or keep it a secret, and they want money or personal information from you. So however it attacks you, listen for one of those cues, and then you'll know you're involved in a scam.
Oh, that's very good advice. And I'm just curious, Amy, I mean, you work at AARP, which is the Association for Retired People. Are scams like these targeting older adults more often? Are older adults more vulnerable to these? Or do scams like this affect all of us?
These scams are targeting every single one of us. Every single one of us has a target on our back. It doesn't matter who you are, what your education level is, or where you live. But let's be real, and older adults do hold the majority of wealth in the United States. So a scammer would probably rather steal from a retired person who's worked hard their whole life than, you know, maybe my 21-year-old son in college, right, who doesn't have that money. So they'll steal from anyone, but they're going to rather go to the big dollar amounts.
Yeah. I mean, Aaron, does that surprise you at all? I mean, that as Amy was saying, it's like they're using these tools, AI as a tool, to conduct old types of scams. I mean, is the quality of those tools, does it make the scam feel more real? Miss Malaysia seem more like a real person? I mean, is it the intensity and the realistic nature of the scam that's improved? Aaron?
Looks like
Aaron, are you there?
Looks like she got dropped, but I could certainly answer
Amy,
question on her
please,
behalf.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it does. And, you know, I hear the fear in people a lot. You know, they fear this, the AI and the technology that's out there. And again, we don't want people to be fearful. We want people to be empowered. So instead of trying to look at a picture and try to determine if it was created using AI, again, I'd rather people listen for that ask. Because I have people tell me a lot of times, like, oh, you know, they can fake your grandchild's voice. They can steal your grandchild's voice offline and make it sound like him and call and say they're in prison. And I always kind of just take a deep breath and just think about it. Okay, yes, they could do that. Mm-hmm. But also, is your grandchild going to be calling you from prison and asking you for a prepaid gift card? Or are they going to be asking you to go to a cryptocurrency ATM? No. So again, listen for the ask and not really pay attention to the shiny, glossy picture.
Yeah, we did a show about somebody who was scammed by the voice, right? That their child was in jail and that these horrible things had happened and they needed, you know, this kind of money. And honestly, to your point, Amy, it's like they get you into this heightened emotional state. But the voice for this person sounded so real that even the implausible scenario seemed plausible to the victim.
And it's really hard, you know, because one, we're not in that emotional state. So we can all sit here and kind of, you know, be the couch judge and look at them and say, you know, how did you know? And what, you know, did it sound like? And all that kind of stuff. And really kind of judge the victim, which we don't want to do. They're in that heightened emotional state. And honestly, a lot of times we believe what we believe and we hear what we want to hear. And so, again, when you're in that state, when you're feeling flutter, your heart is beating, you know, take a beat, take a pause, take a breath, whatever it is, and just say to yourself, you know what? I'm going to call my grandchild or my family member at the number I have for them, and I'm going to check on the situation. Because I don't think prisons in the United States take prepaid gift cards for bail.
I would hope not, but still, I mean, Aaron, there was a report from Reuters recently conducted an investigation where they tried to enlist the help of six different AI chatbots, from ChatGPT to Claude to Gemini, to help create a phishing email to defraud seniors. Initially, the chatbot said, "Nope, we can't help you with that." But then, when the researcher said, "Oh, it's for a novel. I'm writing it for research," these chatbots readily complied with lots of schemes. I mean, that the fact that chatbots can be so easily persuaded to override any guardrails they programmed to help with preventing fraud is troubling, isn't it?
Sure, that's definitely not good news at all. But I would say that, goodness, I would have to agree with Amy with a lot of what she's saying, in that we don't have specific evidence other than what I told you earlier about this actually happening. We don't know that. So I think that, honestly, when we think about what's happening out there, it probably makes good sense to not over fear what is happening, and instead focus on what we do know. And what we do know is we are going to get contacted. You are going to get a scam message today. And so to be prepared for the idea that any incoming electronic communication that you did not ask for could be a scam is our best approach, rather than trying to figure out whether it's AI or not AI. What we do know is they're coming for us. So let's get our defenses up.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. Tonight, we're discussing how AI is giving scammers powerful new tools, from cloned voices to fake emails that look incredibly real. We're talking with former prosecutor Aaron West and ARP's Amy Nofziger about how these scams work, who they target, and most importantly, what steps you can take to protect yourself. We'd love to hear from you. Have you lost money or personal information to a scam that used AI? Do you know somebody who has been hurt by such a program? What happened and what advice would you share? You can join our conversation. Give us a call now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. I mean, I like this idea of making sure that we're skeptical enough but not living in fear when we get messages. A lot of times, Amy, I get these text messages from random numbers. I don't know who they are, and they just say something like, "Hello, are you there?" Is that something I should respond to or just delete?
Delete. 100% delete. So that is nothing but an entry point to a cryptocurrency, or as some people call, a pig butchering scam.
Ooh.
So you're a nice person. You're going to respond, and you're going to say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, you have the wrong number." And they're going to write back and say, "Oh my gosh, you're so nice. Thank you so much. Where are you located?" Conversation ensues. They're going to send you some fancy pictures about their lifestyle. And then they're going to offer you the opportunity to invest with their aunt's mother's cousin's brother, who's an expert in cryptocurrency. Right now, I will say, and Aaron, I'm not sure if you're going to agree with me on this, but this is the number one entry point to any cryptocurrency or pig butchering scam that we're seeing right now. And every day on the Fraud Watch Network helpline, and I'm sure at Operation Shamrock as well, we are getting victims who are losing their life savings in this scam.
What is pig butchering? I mean, that sounds horrible.
I'm going to turn it over to the absolute expert on that, Aaron, to answer that question for you.
Well, Amy, you set me up beautifully because you already started the conversation. What happens with those is, you know, we've got a situation where we've got a loneliness crisis in the United States, and people are susceptible to those type of conversations being started with them. The idea of pig butchering is that it's a long con, and that it does not end until the scammer has taken every penny you have. So those scammers will invest months in developing this relationship, and just like Amy said, showing you fancy pictures of their elevated lifestyle. And ultimately, they will suggest that you too could have an elevated lifestyle like this if you invested in the cryptocurrency scheme that their uncle has taught them. And what we also are seeing at the moment is a presidential administration that is embracing crypto. There's a lot of FOMO out there. There's a lot of people wanting to get on this bandwagon and make some money for their family. And so they're a little more vulnerable than they would normally be. They'll make investments, they'll see fictitious returns, they'll see a beautiful dashboard presented to them showing them that they've made money, but in fact that money's been stolen from them. And then the scammer will then encourage them to put more and more money in it. And I am not understating it when I tell you that people are putting their entire life savings into these fake platforms and ending up talking to me and Amy when they realize that they've lost $1 million in a scam like this. This is happening at scale. I know you and I are both Bay Area, certainly in the Bay Area, but also all over the United States.
So in this scenario, I guess the victim is the pig?
Yes.
Yikes.
That's the idea. The idea is you are fattening up the pig with love bombs, and then you are slaughtering the pig to take everything they have.
I mean, well, I can't tell you how many of those I receive on any given day. I don't respond to them, and I'm glad that I haven't even, I just delete them when I see them. So your advice, if you get a text from a complete stranger, a number that you don't recognize that says, hello, how are you, or are you there, or, you know, without your name or anything, is to just delete it. Is that right, Amy?
100% delete it, and do not engage. Like, I've had people say to me, oh, I like to play with them because then I'm just wasting up their time to, you know, something else. No, absolutely not, because then they're going to know that there's someone who's willing to answer them. Just delete it, ignore it, block the number if you choose to, but they'll just come up with another number. But just don't engage.
I mean, what are some other scams like that, Erin, that I should be kind of keeping my eye out for? I mean, we all have heard about the Nigerian prince from the 80s and the 90s. What else is out there?
Sure. What's happening in bulk right now are the toll scams. And frequently, I mean, by chance, you probably will have driven over a Bay Area bridge. Mm-hmm. And you think, oh, goodness, did I pay that toll? I can see your member in backstage right now telling me he has too. That's the thing, is they get you on your vulnerable point. They don't get you when you're at the top of your game on a Monday morning. They get you when you're coming home from work and you've got to make dinner and you've got to pick up your kid and you're late for daycare. And you see that you've got a toll and you're like, I've got to pay that. And that's what happens. And so there's that one. There's the job scam. And the thing is, these scammers are going after all age groups. And so even while Amy is handling seniors, her Fraud Watch Network will talk to anyone of any age who has been victim to a scam. And one of the ones that's hitting our younger generation who's having trouble getting jobs out of college these days is the job scam. And they make it look like a legitimate job. And by the end of that job scam, you'll owe them, you will have lost $5,000, $7,000.
Well, how does that job scam work exactly? You're paying them to find you a job, or?
No, you are being offered a job by essentially clicking on things to elevate ratings in search optimization. And you will be told that you are entitled to this much money, but you have to deposit a certain amount of money to get that money out. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, for a lot of people who just aren't familiar with the scam, the problem with all of these scams is they go to extra efforts to make this all seem very real. Mm-hmm. In those scams that you hear about where people believe they're talking to their child, they are then also talking to someone they believe is a lawyer, and they're talking to someone they believe is the court of the clerk, and then they're talking to someone again, and all of the corroboration of other stories leads people to believe that this is very real. And so it's just like the Nigerian prince in that this is not going to stop until everybody knows about it. Mm-hmm. We ended the Nigerian prince. Our best efforts now should be on ending these current scams.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, in the past, it was through email, and people are very, I think, familiar with the idea that, oh, through email, I'm going to get a lot of spam, a lot of junk. And they're able to just sort of deal with that. But texting is new to many of us, especially to the older generation. Amy, is a scam perpetuated by texting one that feels like people are more vulnerable to? Just because it's new?
Yeah, and I think it's just the fact that we carry our phones with, let me say, I say phone, but really we carry our mini computers with us 24/7, right? When was the last time you actually made a phone call on that device, right? Yeah. It's a mini computer. And so the scammers used to only be able to reach us when we were, you know, at our door, at our phone. Now they can reach us 24/7, when I'm at a traffic light, when I'm at the doctor's office, in the waiting room. And, you know, as we've been on this call right now, I've gotten text. I look out of the corner of my eye. I see it's my husband. I can wait a second to respond to him. But if it was something that was like important, maybe I'd pay attention to it if it was from an unknown.
Oh, I think we lost you.
Number, oh my gosh, maybe it's an emergency. And I think the criminals know that. Mm-hmm. They know we make these quick decisions to what to pay attention to. And once we pay attention to it, then they get us in that ether with urgency, excitement, fear, whatever it is. And that's why I think right now on our helpline, I think texts are probably the entry point for most of our scams right now. Phone as well, and then, of course, social media. But text is certainly up there as an entry point.
We have an email from Jackson who asks, how effective are reporting programs that some cell carriers have in reporting numbers of potential scammers? Verizon asks that you forward any scam numbers to 7726, but I'm not sure what that does. Aaron, do you know?
If Amy knows, I'll defer to her, but what I will say is it really doesn't matter because they've got a million numbers. Yeah. So it's great if you forward that number, but to be honest, I'm not aware of a program that's actively deactivating numbers based on those reports. Amy?
I would say I think that reporting is important for people to feel empowered. So if you do report the phone number, then you will report the email, and you will report the text, and you will report if you're a victim. I encourage people to report to legitimate sources whenever they can, because it is a crime attempt, right? And if anyone had a crime attempt and tried to break into your car, you would certainly report that. And the companies do look at the data, and especially with the text messages and the emails, and they do try to go through there and find words that then they could put into their filters. So then maybe you won't get that text or email again. But as Aaron said, the criminals are just going to come up with a new phone number. But I just think personally that empowerment of reporting, that's what we need in this country, is people to feel empowered to report these crimes.
And who should they be reporting them to?
You know, it depends on the crime, first and foremost, I like to say, but I always say start local. Start with your local law enforcement, right? Especially if you are a victim of a crime, start there. Then certainly, you know, if the crime and most of the crimes do happen online, report it to IC3. That's the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center. If it had anything to do with, you know, pig butchering or cryptocurrency, certainly report it to Operation Shamrock. But I also say this, if you don't know where to report it, you can always start with us at ARP. And you can talk one-on-one with a trained volunteer, a fraud fighter, who will guide you on the steps. Because what we have found out, and I'm sure Aaron feels the same way at Operation Shamrock, is oftentimes the victims come to us knowing that they've been a victim of a crime, knowing that the chances of their money being recovered is gone. They just need that emotional support and someone to listen to them with kindness and empathy. And that's what both of our groups provide.
Yeah, I was thinking about how sometimes people, when they've been duped, they feel kind of stupid or silly, like, how could I have fallen for that? And the shame or embarrassment might prevent them from telling, you know, a trusted friend or maybe a son or a daughter who might help them kind of figure out what the problem is. Aaron, how can you talk to a victim of a crime like this, or kind of prevent, you know, have a conversation to even prevent this from happening in the first place?
I think we always need to lead with empathy. We don't know where that person was on that day that they began this conversation. What we do know is that the enemy is very skilled, and that once that door is open, they know all the psychological tips and tricks to lead someone into it. So once we lead with empathy, we might be able to get people to tell us more about what happened to them. But the reason we really need them talking is because we don't even understand how big the problem is right now, because the enemy's chosen a very specific crime that is embarrassing. And so a lot of people don't report. And so we can't even focus on how large this problem really is.
Do we have any sense, Aaron or Amy, where the locus of this crime is taking place? I mean, is it organized crime? Where does it emanate from? Do we have any information about that for, like, for example, the crypto scam that you were talking about earlier, Amy?
So Amy did point to me because I've been on the ground over there. And so what we do know is this is, for the most part, I'm not going to see every scam, but for the most part, the lion's share of this is coming from Chinese organized crime syndicates who are operating in Southeast Asia, and they're operating out of massive compounds, the size of a tech campus in Silicon Valley, with buildings filled with human trafficked victims. Hundreds of thousands of people are stuck in forced criminality on the other side of your phone. So that's just one more reason I tell you not to engage or taunt these victims, because you're actually taunting victims. Oh. You're taunting people who have been forced to work there. And so what we really have, we can't understate the gravity of what's happening. We have a massive humanitarian and national security crisis in the amount of money that is getting moved globally into the hands of transnational organized crime is a generation's worth of wealth. And there's a lot more that needs focus and attention on how we combat this as a globe.
We have an email from Hanafi from San Francisco who writes, can law enforcement use AI to stop or slow scams by monitoring for federal wire and electronic transfers, or at least notify the sender where their electronic transfer is really going before the money actually gets transferred? I mean, I think this brings up a point, Amy, about what is law enforcement doing to help slow down or eradicate these criminal organizations?
I can certainly answer, and then I'd love to hear Aaron, who, you know, is a former prosecutor in this. But, you know, one of the things is we don't always know what law enforcement is doing, and sometimes that's on purpose, right? Because they're doing their job behind the scenes, and so the criminals can't catch on. But in my 23 years, I actually have more hope than I ever have when it comes to these crimes. And I know that might sound weird because we are all coming together. I remember when it was just a couple of us sitting around a table talking about these crimes, and now it's everybody. Everybody is talking about these crimes and looking at the tools that we can all use to stop them, educate people, looking at the laws. So it's a big force that we're trying to fight these crimes. Aaron, so what's your thought on the law enforcement?
I would say that Amy's probably a little more optimistic than I am, but what I can tell you is that there are a lot of good people who really care about this. And there are a lot of good people on the federal level, on the local level, on the state level. There's a lot of good people in banking. There's a lot of good people in victim support. So Amy is correct that I feel like the time is now, that the bell has been rung, that we understand the scope and scale of what we're up against. And if not now, when? Because everybody is now unnoticed. So I'll end my thoughts with just being really optimistic with Amy, and I hope that we see some change.
Well, before we let you guys go, and I did say that you were the dynamic duo, and I think I was right about that. Amy, tell me where a person can go if they want more information about scams and how to help themselves.
Absolutely. First, I'll give a website. It's aarp.org/fraudwatchnetwork. There you can find the Fraud Resource Center, tools, anything you can to protect yourself and your family members. But more importantly, if you have any questions about fraud or have been a victim of fraud, call our toll-free helpline. It's free for anyone of any age, and you do not have to be an AARP member. And that number is 877-908-3360.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. There's so much more to discuss, but go to those two resources because I think you'll learn a lot more. We've been talking to Amy Nofziger, Director of Victim Support at AARP's Fraud Watch Network, and Aaron West, a former district attorney, assistant district attorney, and founder of Operation Shamrock. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, Ann Harper sits down with the Mill Valley Film Festival Programming Director, Zoe Elton. Stay tuned.
This week on Bay Made, we are featuring Accented, a show hosted by Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen that fosters engaging and culturally insightful conversations across the Vietnamese and Southeast Asian diaspora. So tune in all week at 11:30 a.m. to Bay Made, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, Bay Area.
I'm Lynn Winter Gross.
And I'm Miriam Goodman. We are the hosts of Not Born Yesterday. Our show explores the joys and challenges of aging with advice from experts in the field.
As the baby boomer generation ages, understanding the experiences of family caregiving and the challenges it presents is a worldwide issue. We're going to be talking all about it. Join us Monday at 7 p.m. for Not Born Yesterday.
Right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. The Mill Valley Film Festival is back and bringing some of the year's most talked about films and hidden gems right here in the Bay Area. From Oscar contenders to bold new voices, the lineup is always a feast for film lovers. Joining us tonight is Zoe Elton, the director of programming who has been curating the festival's unique mix of big screen magic for the last several decades. She's here to share what's in store for this year and tip us off on a few films we won't want to miss. Zoe Elton, welcome to State of the Bay.
Well, thank you, Anne. It's great to be here.
So tell me, what excites you most about this year's lineup?
Oh, you know, I'm excited that we have some hidden gems that people might not find otherwise. There's a documentary called State of Firsts, which is about Sarah McBride, directed by Chase Joint. I mean, that, I think, will be pretty special.
Sarah McBride is from Delaware, correct?
Yes. Our first transgender congressperson. So that feels timely. As we've been developing the program over the last several months, it was very interesting to come into this year thinking, what are we going to be able to do? This is a very particular kind of climate that we're showing all these films in.
Right.
And there's something great about showing films from around the world that address issues that have a certain resonance both in the location that they're from, but also for us. So, for instance, there's a film by an Israeli filmmaker whose name is Or Sinai called Mama. And it's essentially about immigration. It centers on a Polish woman who's working for a wealthy family and has been living with the family for a long time, then goes back to connect with her family in Poland. And despite all the time that she has had sending money and really supporting the family financially, the emotional disconnect becomes very evident. So narrative film takes the challenges and the crises that you can go through in a very human way and informs us in a way that is kind of safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mama is one of those that does that. It's a very good film. Other things that I'm excited about, there's a film called Yanuni, which is really about the Amazon rainforest and the politics behind that, and specifically about an indigenous chief and climate champion. People have tried to assassinate her, I think, about six times. Kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. But I think she's going to be joining us for one of the screenings. So that's pretty special.
Mm-hmm. I know there was at least one entry that was filmed right in San Francisco, Brother versus Brother, which was executive produced by Francis Ford Coppola. And I understand some improvised one-take musical about twin brothers hunting through the streets of North Beach for their missing father. I read that Roger Ebert said it's unlike anything. I'm really curious. What can you tell us about this film?
Yeah, this is great. The brothers Gold, as they call themselves, are twin brothers whose father, Herbert Gold, was a beloved San Francisco writer. And they make a film in which the one brother is busking on a street corner in North Beach, San Francisco. The other brother comes and joins him. They are very, very different personalities. And the camera follows them through the streets without stopping on this 90-minute journey that is just fun. They do end up at their dad's house. And in an odd twist of fate, their father died not long after the film was completed. But yes, it is also done in one complete shot. So it's kind of audacious and wonderful in that way.
And there are two other films with local roots, Everywhere Man, The Lives and Times of Peter Asher. I understand that was made by San Francisco filmmakers.
Yes, Dan Gehler and Dana Goldfein. So I'm a Brit, as you can probably tell. Mm-hmm. And I am familiar with Peter Asher from way, way back. So he is not that familiar to American audiences, but the impact that he has had on popular culture means that witnessing his story will make you realize, oh my God, he did that. As a young man, Peter Asher got to know Paul McCartney. He became a record producer. One of the people that he discovered and signed was this young American artist, James Taylor, and produces records, but then also brought into the fold Carole King, mm-hmm. who he persuaded, despite her shyness, to perform, and then Linda Ronstadt. So he continues to work with a roster of people that is absolutely phenomenal. So it's a really great story and locally done.
That's so fun. I understand there's also a film about the San Francisco Giants pitcher, Masanori Murakami.
Produced by Max Mollowitz, who's a very beloved local film producer. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have some very special guests with that screening as well.
So unlike the news lately, a lot of the film trailers just seem like they had a calm pacing or with deep character investigation. I mean, was that your experience, or do you want to reflect on pacing in general and how viewers experience that?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that in the context of right now. I do think that a lot of the films that we've seen and chosen for this year's Mill Valley Film Festival are coming from a very considered point of view, but also are being made by people who are confident in their aesthetics, and the way that they want to tell stories, whether the story that they're telling is through a documentary or a narrative or a short film or a children's film. So there is that sort of interesting unfolding. I mean, I think the beginning of the festival, we're opening with Hamnet, which is the new Chloe Zhao film. I think that's probably almost like a prime example of what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really exquisitely made.
I understand that has Oscar buzz around it.
Oh, yeah. Much Oscar buzz. But you can see almost in every frame of the film the incredible trust that was obviously built up with material that can be very challenging. I mean, it's, as you probably know, the story is about Shakespeare's wife, about whom we know very little historically.
Mm-hmm.
But the film really explores and creates a fictionalized version of a woman who married this young man, quite a few years younger than she, and who's a force of nature.
I'm sure tickets will be in short supply for that. Can you give any tips to our listeners about getting tickets?
Yeah, I would say don't give up. There will be tickets released. We also do rush lines, you know, if you're available to be in Marin. Mm-hmm. So I would say just keep on checking if something looks like it's on standby. We call it on standby for a reason. There are usually tickets that are going to be available on the day of, even for things like opening night.
Well, Zoe Elton, thank you so much for being with us on State of the Bay.
Well, thank you, Anne. It's been a pleasure.
That was Zoe Elton, Director of Programming for the Mill Valley Film Festival, which runs October 2nd through the 12th, with screenings in Mill Valley, Larkspur, San Rafael, and Berkeley. You can find the full lineup, tickets, and special event details at the link on the State of the Bay page on kalw.org.
Well, I can't wait for the Mill Valley Film Festival. It sounds awesome. And that is State of the Bay this week. Join us next week when we sit down with Andrew Durham. He's a director of the film Fairyland. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have any questions or comments about today's show, give us a call or send us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was fully produced by Ann Harper. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Tarek, our D minor, sorry about that, was our amazing board operator. Stay tuned to hear KALW's new podcast in residence, Not Born Yesterday. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.